welcome to the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast with me, Nicole Sachs. You are here. Hello, everybody. Happy fall. Here we are. This is Nicole, and you've reached my podcast, The Cure for Chronic Pain, with me, Nicole Sachs. Welcome to it. Today, we have a treat, a first of many kinds. Lisa and I will be interviewing Elise Lunin. And so let me tell you a little bit about Elise, and then we're going to get into why we chose her incredible new book, which is called On Our Best Behavior, The Price Women Pay to Be Good. Very, very interesting parallel to TMS work. So Elise is the host of her own podcast. It's called Pulling the Thread. She has co-written 12 books, five of which were New York Times bestsellers. And prior to this current work she's in, Elise was the chief content officer of Goop, a lifestyle and e-commerce company you may have heard of, where she co-hosted the Goop podcast and also the Goop Lab on Netflix. It was a series where Elise and her team went through many different interesting healing modalities. It definitely was one of my favorites when it was on. Previously, Elise was the editorial projects director of Condé Nast Traveler, and she lives in LA, as do I, with her two sons. So Elise was a person that originally came on our radar because we loved the work that she did with Goop, and we loved her bravery in tackling sort of cutting edge modalities of healing and being interested in looking outside the box for solutions. And then we came across her book On Our Best Behavior, The Price Women Pay to Be Good. And, you know, immediately Lisa and I started discussing it and we're like, this is so related to TMS work. You know, why do we have to be good? You know, what's going on here? So, you know, I'm really excited for this week's podcast for many reasons. First of all, it's the first of its kind in terms of format. Three people instead of two, Lisa and I both interviewing Elise versus what normally I do with the Real Time Heal or the Success Story. So it's interesting to start playing with different formats for the podcast and switching it up. And it's also the first of its kind because we wanted to bring this discussion to you because Elise's book and the work we do here as a community are an incredibly interesting fit. So you're about to hear in detail all the reasons why, but her premise is how women repress their true nature and all the requisite emotions in pursuit of goodness. God, I mean, it just reminds me of Dr. Sarno and his whole thing about the personality, the type T personality, and how we're all goodists and we want to be, you know, seen as a good person doing a good job and the perfectionism that elicits. So it all just made us really interested. What initially grabbed our attention was Elise's own story. So it's not just her commentary on the world and on our roles. Her intense jaw pain that it was suggested to her indicated that she was muzzling the desire to bite someone. So very interesting via our work. And her inability to get a deep breath, another symptom imperative that Elise had that made her feel like she was drowning. So obviously both symptoms that we can clearly see through the lens of TMS. So in this interview, you'll hear Lisa and I talk to Elise in detail about her model that is based on the seven deadly sins, how anger stems from repressing our own needs, and how we lack the tools to unpack and metabolize rage, something we talk about here quite a bit, how shame is used against women as a form of oppression, and how envy lies at the center of all conflict between women. And although Elise discusses women specifically, and I know a large portion of our audience here on the podcast is women, this really applies to everyone. Because when we step outside our gender roles, anytime we are repressing huge parts of ourselves, TMS is going to express that for us. So in this interview, we talk about how when the system refuses to hear women, and we can't share our anger with our bosses, partners, parents, that the repressed emotions transmute into blaming and shaming and coming out sideways. Or, of course, they get turned inward. And we come to know that the solution space, where you know we love to live in this podcast and the solution, which we share with Elise and TMS Theory, is the tools we use to explore interventions, how we try to disrupt the model. and the ways in which we do the work to not hand trauma down to the next generation, which we all know is so important. And that helps us restore faith and agency in ourselves. So I think you're going to really love this one. And remember to be in touch with us so we know how this programming that we're offering here on the podcast is affecting you. You can go to SpeakPipe. That's www.speakpipe.com/Nicole Sacks and leave us a message that Lisa and I hear every single one of them. And make sure you let us know if you are willing to be featured on the podcast, because SpeakPipes get featured on this podcast all the time. And if you are looking for more help and support, just know that Lisa and I also host a membership community. So that is, we have twice a month Zooms where we're interacting with you personally. We're knowing your names. We're knowing your faces. We're answering your questions. And we're also on our private member community every day working with you. So those of you who are always writing me messages and emails about how can I just get personal advice from you, this is how. And Lisa and I are doing that with you guys every month. And it's been really, really impactful. And we have an interview coming up in a couple weeks with one of our community members who is just so incredible, and her journey is evolving. And we did a real-time heal with her. It's just, it's really, really exciting to watch you guys change and grow. And I love being part of it. So if you would like to be part of that membership community, you just go to my website, thecureforchronicpain.com, scroll down just a titch where you'll see the button to sign up and be a member and be on our Zooms and be in the community and ask your questions personally of me. And so I can answer them for you. All right. Any other questions? Just go to thecureforchronicpain.com and a lot of resources there that can help you out. In the meantime, please enjoy this fascinating conversation with Lisa Eisenpresser, myself, and Elise Lunin. And if you're interested in Elise's book, you can get that anywhere books are sold. It is called On Our Best Behavior, and it's amazing. Enjoy. Hi, everyone. Today we are here with Elise Lunin. Welcome, Elise.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. So over the past couple weeks, Lisa and I have been devouring your book. And it's really excellent and really well done. And one of the things that has been so meaningful to us is the way Lisa's been pointing out to me, like every time she sees something, she's like, this tracks perfectly to this in our work, to that in our work. And we never considered the seven deadly sins before. So it's really a fresh lens to look through. And it's exciting because it's another way to connect this work to the greater message. So Lisa, why don't you just get us started? Because I know you had so many ideas about this.
I just want to say that reading your book, I found myself doing what I always do, which I've come to see is something that you always do too. And that's making connections between your theories and ideas and the work that Nicole teaches that's originally based in Dr. Sarno's theories. And then connecting your argument, which itself is mapped to the seven deadly sins, to some of these systems and ideas that have informed my past projects. And of course, today's podcast that I produce for Nicole. So while I'd be reading, every time any of these connections occurred to me, I'd like make a note in the margin, the Enneagram or the teen mental health crisis or Eastern spirituality or ascension. And I would find that within a half an hour, it would appear in your book through your own
I love it.
It was wild. I mean, so it was really wild.
At times it would be really eerie. And at times I was just ecstatic, but mostly really feeling excited that Nicole and I were meeting someone, another ally, someone who could potentially even be a collaborator in bringing the world the healing that it so badly needs. And I don't know how much you know about the work that Nicole does, but I'd love to do for our audience today, who is extremely familiar with Nicole's work, because of course they come to it having been helped to understand the agency that they have over their diagnoses, their conditions, their mindset, their perspective. I'd love to discuss the places that it intersects with your message. So let's start by telling everyone the central premise of your book.
Yeah. So the central idea is that women are coded and programmed for goodness, and men are programmed and conditioned for power. And that in this sort of patriarchal society, like you guys, I try or aspire to be a system thinker. I really want to understand the closet in which, you know, all of these clothes live. I really wanted to sort of understand or place myself in a larger historical context around what I observed to be all of these self-limiting messages and this idea that it was chasing me, that I wasn't enough. Yeah. And I think that for most women, we hear these voices and we think that they're our own, and or we try to place them on our parents or our teachers. You know, we're looking for their source. And often, I think sometimes we think that maybe that is the source. It could be the source, but to me, it feels like these are much more resounding, bigger cultural forces, archetypal forces. And so that's the premise. And I wanted to understand both sort of within this culture that we live in, which is a patriarchal culture, how did that start? Was it a foregone conclusion where men are invariably more powerful and stronger than women? Is that sort of our natural destiny, which is what I think most of us are told? Or is that a story that we've grown up on and made true? And so that being one part of it. And then where did this structure get married to morality? And then why is that specifically lodged in the minds and bodies of women, this idea of goodness? Because when you think about the seven deadly sins, and just to clarify for listeners, I didn't grow up in a religious house. I didn't sort of imbibe these ideas. So in a way I was like, these can't be in me. There's no way. This is not my belief system, but they're culture, and culture is contagious, and we whisper it into each other, but they are sloth, envy, pride, greed, gluttony, lust, and anger. And there was actually a seventh, which I think is also critical for your work. There were originally these eight thoughts that came out of the Egyptian desert at the hands of a desert monk who is also credited as an early father of the Enneagram. They came out of the Egyptian desert at the same time that the New Testament was being canonized. So they're not in gospel. They were this book that then in the sixth century became the cardinal vices. These eight thoughts became the seven deadly sins, the cardinal vices, and they were assigned in that same homily to Mary Magdalene, in the same homily that she became a penitent prostitute. And so that to me was like, oh, now I understand. I understand where this came from and how this game of telephone is with us still and distorting our lives and creating these false narratives and scripts about who we are and how we're supposed to behave and show up in this world.
And I know that the eighth one is sadness.
Yes.
That you were mentioning. And that is indeed, you're right to say, incredibly important to our work.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And that one is for men, I think, the most pernicious.
Yes, absolutely. In the different way that men and women deal with it. But I love how you say that you look for how these came to be lodged, not just in our minds, but in our bodies.
Yes.
It brings us really to the nexus of our work. Something that Nicole says a lot, which illustrates mind-body theory, is sometimes we feel things in our hearts and sometimes we feel things in our body, and they are literally interchangeable.
Yeah.
In your book, you mentioned various moments of extreme physical distress. That's how you get us into it. You talk about your hyperventilation. You talk about a tight and aching jaw pain, neck pain. Can you tell us more about these symptoms and what they indicated to you in your life?
Yeah. So I opened the book talking about my chronic hyperventilation. And ironically, my dad is a pulmonologist. And yet I still didn't know what was happening to me. I thought I was, you know, when it first started happening in my 20s, I thought I went to the emergency room. I thought I was dying. I mean, it's similar to a panic attack in the sense that you're just offline, you know, and with real physical symptoms.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very alarming, you know, and it's not breathing into a paper bag, that type of breathing. It is this feeling that you can't take a deep breath and you sort of tap out at the top. You can only take a deep breath if you yawn. And it's because your body is actually oversaturated with oxygen, but somehow there's a disconnection and you are very alive with the feeling that you are not breathing completely. And so it just continues to throw you into disarray. And, you know, nobody will be surprised, but when I went to the ER, they sent me home with a pat on the back and a Xanax prescription and told me it was all in my head and I was fine. And in some ways I was fine, sure, but I was not okay.
Right.
And yet it also, to me, has been sort of this syndrome that's chased me throughout the years, because I've also never been able to sort of say, oh, well, it's just when I have these thoughts, or, you know, for me, it's this sea, the soup of anxiety that I swim in that sort of is also compounded by over caffeination or sleep deprivation or whatever it is. But it is this persistent, oppressive eventuality. And at this point in my life, when I opened the book, I'm in my therapist's office, and I'd been hyperventilating or in this cycle for 2 months or so, every day. I maybe would have some relief in the morning, but by the afternoon I was there, and I was like, this is crazy. I am this high achieving woman. I've always done the right thing. I work so hard to be good at my job, at being a parent, at being a good partner. And yet I am just swimming in anxiety and these feelings that I'm not enough and I can't keep going. Like, this is not a good way to live. This is a terrible way to live. And at that point, I really was like, I need to understand what it is. Like, what are these voices?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, it's a real knot for me, because it's not like the awareness of my book and doing all the work required to sort of therapize myself through my relationship with food and my relationship to sex and all of these body-based, often quote unquote sins. It's not like I'm like, oh, I'm healed.
Right.
But I am definitely much more aware of the way that my world impacts my health and any feelings of just wellness.
Yeah. So you opened like a really beautiful door by explaining it that way. So
you're going to go right on
through
there.
Do it.
Can I even begin? Okay. The first thing I want to say, Elise, even though this is not a real-time heal. So just so you know, like on this podcast, we have this sort of mini series within a podcast called Real-Time Heal, where someone comes on, they tell me what's going on with them, and we do like a real-time therapy session on air. So don't be afraid. I'm not going to suggest you do that, but I do need to say to you, I have seen over the 20 plus years that I've been doing this, thousands of people, because I work with people around the world, especially since COVID when everything went virtual, who have recovered completely from exactly what you're saying, doing this mind-body work that Lisa and I are going to talk to you about for the next hour. And it's like, when I became interested in your book just because I heard it was about repressed emotions. And then I turn on the Audible, I'm walking on the beach, you know, I'm all in my head getting ready for my move, and you open the book with this And I'm like hyperventilation. And I'm just like, you got to be fucking kidding me.
Served up to you.
Exactly. So the first thing I wrote in my notes app is, make sure to tell Elise that she can be completely well and 100%. And we can take that offline.
Symptom free. Yeah.
But let me explain briefly to you what TMS is, because that will help us get further into this conversation. So as we mentioned, Dr. Sarno, and I know Elise is familiar with his work, he worked primarily at the beginning talking about back pain, but actually, if you read his further books, one of which is The Mind-Body Prescription, he talks about all different TMS equivalents, which could be anything from migraines to fibromyalgia to irritable bowel to hyperventilation to pelvic pain to skin disorders and on and on and on. And of course, includes all the bodily pain, neck, back, shoulder, knee, hip, whatever. And TMS is an umbrella acronym, under which all of these conditions lie. And the most important thing to understand about them is, and it's like written on my website as the footer, is the pain is not in your head, but the solution is not in your body. Mm. And I think, it's such powerful work, because it tracks so beautifully to everything you do, because first of all, my population is 98% women. And that's probably a conservative estimate. And welcome 2% men, we want to grow you. But the point is that women generally feel, cue on our best behavior, shut down, silenced, marginalized, not able to feel our feelings, not able to rest, not able to be sexual, not able to be angry, not able to eat. And so all of those things require a tremendous amount of repressed emotions. Yes. And the seminal thing about TMS, to explain it, is we all have a reservoir inside of us. Okay. And so you picture like a science beaker inside of us, And if you could picture every time you have a trigger, an emotional reaction, your employee or your boss gives you the side eye, you have a fight with your husband, your kid is giving you a hard time. It's like someone takes a ladle and dumps into that reservoir. And what the reservoir contains, and you also mentioned this in your book, are the unacceptable emotions. So it's not annoyance and irritation and I'm pissed off. It's rage. It's despair. It's shame. It's grief. It's terror. It's not I'm a little nervous and anxious. It's I'm terrified. And when we get those up and when the nervous system stops perceiving the repressed emotional world as an actual predator to your life, a greater predator than feeling these feelings and coming just into peaceful alliance with them and understanding with them, then all of the physical symptoms fall away, because the physical symptoms are a result of the brain staying in sustained fight or flight in fight with a predator to keep a predator away from us, the repressed emotional world. These are all original Sarno theories that I've been evolving for many years, but the whole point of them is that's the reason we're sick as a society.
Right. And your nervous system doesn't ask permission. It makes a split second decision in the same way that it would save you from a bus coming and you come, you're stepping off the curb and you're not going to walk into traffic. It doesn't ask your permission to do that. It also doesn't ask your permission to send the pain into your body rather than allowing you to feel what it considers to be a much more dangerous emotion, something right. that's unresolvable, a conflict that you can't resolve in yeah. that moment.
And sending the, and this is something that I think people get a little confused about is like, well, yeah, no, but I'm hyperventilating. I don't have back pain. And the thing is, your hyperventilation is her migraine, is my stomach ache, is his back pain, because the way it's expressed through the body is actually immaterial because it's all a result of the survival instinct. So we can get more into that, but I just had to say that at the beginning, because it's just so fascinating the way it tracks with so much of what you talk about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the whole book is essentially about when we have been conditioned to hold all of these very human instincts and condition them as bad in this quest to be good, we repress and suppress all of these emotions. We don't even diagnose them. We're just, as you said, they're in that, I call it sort of my frozen lake, but they're in that yes. reservoir. Yeah.
But the good news is that, you know, we lead people into what is the very evident problem, and we get them to all agree that there is a problem. But here we bring people to a solution space, and that we want to.
That's amazing. Yeah. No, and it's amazing. You know, all I wanted to do, well, I wanted to do many things in the book, but was to say, essentially, you're not crazy. Here's the framework. Yeah. All of these, you know, there's so many incredible books and people who have written or thought about women and food, women and anger, women and pride or success stories, women and money, and all of these people belong in the same house. These are all connected. This is all part of a larger system of symptoms, right? But what's the root cause and how do we start to find it in our bodies, which is where I pass the baton to you as someone who tends to dissociate and
I hear you. And there's so many things out there that make you feel, and then you can't feel. That's yeah. what I love what you say. Yeah.
So, and I love that you so brilliantly map it to these seven deadly sins, which we can use your framework and kind of tick off a few of them to illustrate the way it plays out in the chronic pain model. So let's just, I mean, for instance, here's a softball. Let's just talk about sloth a little bit. When we don't give ourselves permission to rest, our bodies will do it for us. And if you hate your job and you don't confront your boss and you repress your needs in the workspace, we will see people get fibromyalgia. We'll see people get chronic fatigue. We'll see them get migraines, all sorts of things that will do that for them. It will take them out of work so they never have to confront the boss. They never have to resolve the conflict. The nervous system will do it for them. It will send their body some form of distraction in the form of pain, and the condition will essentially do it for them. So Nicole, like, how does sloth impact women?
Yeah, that's a huge one. And you pointed it out quite a bit, which is that I'm a mother of three. Lisa's a mother of two. You're a mother of two. You know, we understand what it is to have to do it all. We all work as well. And the point is, it is not societally appropriate to rest. It just straight up isn't, and it's way worse for women. And like you said, sometimes we don't even realize the whispers of these messages and that we take them as our own. And I love the example you gave of you had a friend, I believe, who said, "I almost wish for a fever so yeah. I could have a reason to go to bed." Well, that is such a central tenet that we try to explain to people, which is you think you have no control over your migraine disorder. You think you've gone out into the sun and you've got a migraine. Let me explain to you that there is this tandem process going on where your nervous system is going into fight or flight. An unconscious experience is happening where these pain signals are being sent because the greater predator is your child. Shockingly, the greater predator is your housework. The greater predator is your boss. The greater predator is your friend group. I mean, truly, it can be almost anything when we are not giving ourselves permission to rest. So I think the sloth really resonated for me in I almost feel like that we are like a team, right? It's like you throw up the ball and then I feel like we're going to hit it. It's like, you're saying like, this is a problem. And I'm like, yes. And here's how to solve it. And so that's how I have that experience over and over as I was reading your book.
I love it. Yeah, no, I think, and one of the things that sort of culturally, socially, which I think also goes hand in hand with what you're saying is that the instinct, and I'm going to say this has been my instinct, and I think it's probably collective, or people will resonate with this, is that, you know, my husband had pointed out to me that I hadn't watched more than 20 minutes of a TV show or movie without getting up to do something, getting my computer, just like click, click, clicking, or going into the kitchen to load the dishwasher.
Oh my God. And so relate.
Yes. So this cattle prod, this invisible cattle prod that I'm just like, I get up and it's frustrating to him. He just wants me to like sit on the couch and watch TV, which then just enrages me, right? Because I get into this, like, I do everything, you know, blah, 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 blah. Often an internal fight, but it was sort of this like, oh my God, this isn't him. Actually, he is not saying to me, I expect, 5 square meals a week. I want the floors to be so clean we can eat dinner off of them. Like, he has no expectations of me. This is me imposing this on myself and holding myself to a certain standard that I've established. And that's obviously cultural and it's personal. And so part of it, I think, is instead of projecting it, instead of blaming, which is often more comfortable and more fun, let's be honest. But as part of the book is like, actually, I need to own the fact that, you know, I broke my neck last summer falling off a horse. And I was fine, but I was in a brace for a month. I couldn't drive. I couldn't do anything. And it was after I submitted my book was already in production. It's not in the book, but the experience was exquisitely painful and uncomfortable to sit on the couch, be incapacitated. It was very confrontational for me
but
forced into recovery. Yes. Yeah, but to just watch myself and be like, wow, this is so insistent in me.
Yes. And if I had only just taken it with grace and recovered,
maybe that easier might not said than done.
Easier than done. I mean, anger really though, I'd say sloth, yes, but anger was really the chapter that we were like, this is a slam dunk with TMS theory. Because you know, we're always seeking safety. And you talk about that too, like by pushing down uncomfortable feelings, avoiding conflict, avoiding, you know, potentially damaging our relationships, losing our relationships. But really this repression of anger keeps us, what Nicole likes to say, safe in the unsafest way. Conditions that are, you know, actually not really keeping you safe. We only think that they are. And I want to just kind of tee this up to hear you and Nicole talk about how repressing our anger and our ambition and our desire is done because we think it keeps us safer, but actually it ends up having the opposite effect. So
yeah,
I hand to you first.
Well, anger chapter. I mean, it ended up becoming one of my favorite chapters, but it was, as not surprisingly, one of the hardest ones to wrestle to the ground. And in part because I had to own and face my own anger. And I have tried to disown it for forever. Obviously, I'm not an angry person. I have everything under control and nothing upsets me. And equanimity is my middle name. and I'm not alone, right? We do not like angry women. And there's something about it that is like out of control, unsavory, terrifying. I talk a lot about sort of the goddess, the destructive goddesses that, that are part of our mythology and how destructive female anger is perceived to be. It's very powerful because it is that like, do not tread on me. Yes. These are my needs. These are my boundaries. But I think that what happens to us culturally, which is such a crime, I don't know. I think there's more of this now, but certainly probably when we were all growing up, there wasn't this social emotional learning, right? So kids are, we're all very naturally aggressive. It's just who we are. And we learn through aggression and where's the boundary, et cetera. And we're obviously easy to upset. And for boys, boys are conditioned that that's completely normal and that yelling and kicking and fighting is like what boys do. We don't like it, but it's like kind of respected, let's be honest, right? And girls, on the other hand, that is not what girls do. Girls don't push, they don't yell. And so all that aggression comes out in covert ways. Yeah. And this is really like Rachel Simmons' work, Odd Girl Out, but this is like, this is alliance building, gossiping, backstabbing, all the stuff that we have come to say is what it is to be a woman, right? This is the nature of women. And I call bullshit on that. Yeah. It's just how we're cultured to handle conflict because none of us are taught how to handle it. And so from it, we do not learn. It's okay to let me understand what I'm feeling and needing and what's happening in my body right now. Why am I upset? How do I understand this, process this, and then express it in a functional way, right? I'm not suggesting that like just fire breathing on each other is always productive. But if you look at Marshall Rosenberg's script, who wrote Nonviolent Communication, it's like, I am angry because I am needing, like, you're not blaming the other person. You're not blaming yourself, most importantly, but you are actually identifying the need and articulating what it is and why that need, that lack of that need being met is making you upset.
Yes. And I think, so once again, you're like laying out the problem and then I'm going to pick up all of your information. And I'm going to put it down and I'm going to say, and that is why we are a society of people that are so sick. And yeah. I want to include everyone in this because not everyone has chronic migraines or fibro or stomach stuff or pelvic pain or skin disorders. Or, I mean, if you want to use them, say them all, we're going to have, you can probably have some of them, but everyone has chronic anxiety. Pretty much, you know, or depression. And all of these things are TMS equivalents. One will morph to another and to another. And is primarily because when we push down enough of that natural God-given anger that we all as humans, women and men alike, will experience. And I love how you brought us through child development at one point in the book. And I actually don't know if it was during anger or sadness, but you brought us through child development and said, up until a certain age, in fact, I think it was during sadness, boys are needier. Right.
Boys and girls are they're the same. And then,
but if anything,
they get more upset when a caretaker.
Right. Boys get more upset. Boys cry more easily. Boys are needier. And it's like we get to a point from our societal conditioning where it is unacceptable, especially for women, to have this rage. And we've seen it through politics and we've seen it through other female leaders where if you are angry, if you raise your voice, you are labeled as hysterical or as dramatic, or, you know, things are tossed around like, oh, it must be her time of the month. You know, it's things that shame us into these boxes of not being able to self-express. And then what happens is that stuff by necessity is clocked into this emotional reservoir. And when it hits maximum density and threatens to spill over and move from unconsciousness to consciousness, informing you of how rageful you are, which is tantamount to a threat to your survival. Like you point out, you could be left by your partner. You could be fired from your job. You could be alienated from your children. You could be alienated from yourself. There are so many things that are truly dangerous, perceived as dangerous unconsciously. That when that reservoir hits maximum density, the brain goes into fight or flight, the nervous system informs the brain, we need to be saved, literally. And the signals of fatigue, the signals of anxiety, the signals of pain or any, you know, panic attacks get sent. And what do? We turn our attention from the anger that we feel to specialists, doctor's appointments, laying down, canceling plans. We literally have a perception of control within that diversion space that brings us to a perception of safety. That's safe in the unsafest way.
Yes. No, 1,000%. And yeah, you, as you mentioned, what we're told, and this is true for some people, that what will happen to us if we assert our boundaries, if we assert our needs in relationship, whether with our partner or with our friends, that we will experience loss. We'll experience relationship loss. We'll be cast out. That's like one of the primary threats, right? Is isolation. That's spelt death in our prehistory.
Exactly.
Like Gomorrah. Yeah. Like if you, you won't belong anymore. You'll lose your attachment.
You'll lose your attachment. That if you start changing, your husband will be like, well, this is not what I signed up for. Yes. This is in us deeply, whether it's valid and true or not.
Yes.
Yes. And then there's this idea in your anger chapter that we're always pointing at something that exists out there outside ourselves. And, you know, in our work, we teach people how much time it takes to cultivate the ability to actually pause and begin looking for the root cause within ourselves. So we blame a trigger, but we never get to the root. And what people don't realize is that beneath every behavior is a need, but we're always reacting to the behavior rather than looking at the need, right?
Yeah. And displacing or looking to place again that blame. And there's this difference, and it's so hard to tease out because it like sounds offensive or that you're somehow diminishing what people have experienced. But there's a difference between victimhood and victim consciousness. And so I think a lot of people are victims of life circumstances, of relational harm, whatever it is. I'm not in any way suggesting that people aren't victims. And then at a certain point, there's a difference though, between being a victim and then becoming attached to or entrenched in a victim consciousness where the world is happening to you. This is all happening to you. It's very disempowering, right? Where you're stuck as a victim. And so to say, I am a victim, but I am not going to perpetuate this or play this out in a prolonged way is hard, hard. But essential, I think. Otherwise, you're just stuck, right?
And I want to say also with this whole victim thing, you don't have to. I know that you're being very gentle because you know you don't always know who you're talking to. But this is something that my audience hears from me all the time because it is literally. I just want you to know there's a tab on my website that says like, "I love you, I love you, I apologize, but I'm going to say it." If you want to heal, the most important question you have to ask of yourself is, "How long would I like to suffer?" Because I like to just wake people up into their agency to say, you know, yes, we've been hurt. We've been wronged. We've really been abused. And it's okay to say it. It's okay to name it. I mean, we're going to talk more about that probably in a minute. But once you do so, it's okay to say, I don't choose to live in that story anymore. And that's the beginning of walking out of the woods.
Yeah.
Yes. 1,000%.
Yeah.
And it's tempting. We love the story. A lot of us are really stuck with the story, but it gets very heavy to carry that around.
Yes. And we use it as a distraction. I mean, within the chronic pain model, this idea of focusing outside and blaming the trigger rather than looking within and underneath at the need is kind of, you know, like when we look at it's tantamount to focusing on a symptom, the migraine, the irritable bowel, as you mentioned, the jaw pain or the hyperventilation. We get distracted by our symptoms, which are really just the fire alarm. We have a colleague, Gigi, who talks about this idea that our body provides us this alarm, an indication that something is wrong, whether it's the jaw pain or my migraine or your anxiety. And we spend all our energy then responding to that alarm. So we take the hose and we try to, you know, point it at the alarm rather than trying to put out the actual fire. And I wanted to understand how you see this within your framework, right? The different ways in which men and women deal with anger and conflict, neither of which really go to the cause.
Right. No, 1,000%. And I think that it's, and a lot of it is this, again, this like bias, I guess you could call it, towards outsourcing responsibility. And again, it's like, it gets into, I know it's a safe space. It's just, it's hard to say to people, but to say, you know, for women, it's much easier. And this is also sort of why I wanted to write the book, because I'd look out at, you look out at the equity within society, and it's very convenient to sort of like blame men or blame quote unquote the patriarchy. It's them. And then when I actually started to evaluate those statements in my own life, and yes, I'm a white woman, I have a lot of privilege, certainly. But I couldn't locate that. To me, I was like, this doesn't actually explain what's happening. I've worked for a lot of incredible men. I'm married to like a very sweet feminist guy. I'm the primary breadwinner. I have two small boys. Like, I have never experienced, I've experienced the trauma of our culture and sexual trauma, et cetera, but I've never encountered what we're told sort of has us by the necks, like these misogynistic woman-hating men. And, so part of the book, and then you look at the social science, you look at the 2016 election, and you're like, wow, women are incredibly hard on other women, harder than men. And we say it's because we just expect more from each other, et cetera. But like, what I wanted with this book was to also wake us up. And it goes again to that example I gave about Netflix. This is it, us. This is in us. We are the ones who are perpetuating it, supporting it, policing ourselves, policing each other, while concurrently shaking our fists at like Oz. You know, the patriarchy to me is like Oz. I'm like, there's no one behind the curtain, guys. It's just a system that was set in motion centuries, millennia ago, that is still, we're keeping it alive, and we are participating in that.
Each other. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And of course, there are problematic men. I'm not suggesting that there aren't major cultural issues that we have to contend with, but we have to start with ourselves. And that includes owning, finding, recognizing, embracing all of these repression, all of these things that we've conditioned to believe are bad, that we are storing in our bodies and then projecting onto each other.
Which they did such a nice job in the Barbie movie of.
I know, how weird. I mean, I've been on a. I'm psyched. I'm like, can you add my book to the credits as like suggested reading for anyone who actually wants to go deeper into these themes? Yes. I have been like on Instagram. Ken's primary rodeo shirt. I have been wearing that shirt for years as a joke, but like, the synchronicities are. Staggering.
Yeah. No, yes. I saw that, and I was sitting in the theater going, Elise must be celebrating that.
I know.
Right after her book.
I know. I hope people make the connection. I would just like to sell just like a tiny fraction of books, as I want Mattel. I'm like, can we do a bundled book buy with ticket sales to Barbie?
No, it's actually really, I do believe it's very beshared. And I do think that people who do want to dive deeper, because many do, especially, yeah. Even if it takes a movie to raise the consciousness just a little bit, they're going to find their way to your work.
I hope so. I loved it, but it was wild, like the collective unconscious, like at play. But these ideas, as you guys know, it's like they are present. Yes. They're just like waiting for us to sort of open our eyes.
Yes. Yes.
They are. But I, you know, again, I think it's incredible that it's all coming to light. You do it, you know, absolutely brilliantly in the book. And I still want to give people the tools to take the agency back over their health, over their, you know, careers, over their relationships, just a tool that they can have, like the one that Nicole teaches. I mean, have we even, what, no, like, yeah, let's, why don't you,
yeah, yeah, Tommy, actually, I want the tool. May I please have it?
May I please have the tool?
No,
stop
actually,
teasing me.
What Elise just said, actually, in terms of like how we're storing in our bodies and we need a vehicle to express it. So here you go. So the first thing I'm going to say in explaining this to you is, it oftentimes when people hear about journal speak, which is the primary tool that I developed through my own, by the way, complete personal experience, I was flat on my back, at 19, diagnosed with a very severe spinal condition, told I would never have biological children, I would never travel, exercise, you know, it was very dark. And through my own journey of, you know, in my own way, denying what I felt was being imposed upon me, which at the time was the medical model delivered primarily, no, delivered completely via doctors who were old white men in long coats. And this is nothing against white men or long coats or doctors. It was just totally alienating. Everybody looked at me and said, you are broken, literally. Mm-hmm. And the only way to fix you is to do extreme surgery that has extreme side effects that there is absolutely no guarantee that it will affect your pain. That was what I was hearing. Now, granted, that was in 1990. But not much has changed, especially with the promise of pain cessation. So essentially through my own journey, what I understood is all this science and theory that we're all talking about today. And I went to see Dr. John Sarno in the city, and he explained to me that there must be a vehicle to take this reservoir of rage, sadness, shame, grief, terror, despair, what have you, and allow it simply to move from the unconscious to the conscious. So this is not about changing your life, divorcing your husband, abandoning your children, quitting your job. This is not about changing the level of stress in your life, because we can't. You know, at the very basic, you know, part of it, we have to raise our children and, you know, have human relationships and make money. So we can't, you know, it's not always about changing your life. The pain is necessitated because of the repression, which is why we were so lit up by your book. And so the tool, as simple as it sounds, it's simple, but it's not easy, is a practice I've developed called journal speak. And essentially it is a type of journaling where we give ourselves permission, with the understanding that our repressed emotions are making us sick, to gently and safely, when nobody is looking, allow the feelings from the unconscious to the conscious mind. And, you know, the general, and there's so much to learn about it, obviously, and no one can ever cover it in one interview, is you make three lists. One is childhood triggers, or anything that you consider past triggers that are not currently happening. One is daily life, all the stuff that could be contributing to your current stress. And one is personality. And you talk about this a lot when you talk about the cancer personality, you know, needing to be seen as a good person, being your own worst critic, being codependent, needing everybody else to be, yeah, people pleasing. You know, there are definitely personality types that lead us to be people that carry our stress and our emotions in our bodies and in our anxiety. So essentially, it is a practice where you take 20 minutes a day, and by yourself, completely alone, you journal in the voice of the inner child. You journal in that voice that you, Elise, wish every woman could find within herself. That you journal in that voice that would get you canceled, that would have right. people leave you, that would have your children feel unloved. Literally, it is part of the prescription that you are to speak in a way that would not be heard and received by anyone ever. And you know, the story I tell when I'm telling my own personal story is, I was a young mother at the time. I had kids that were 10 months and 2 years, and I hadn't even had my third yet. And I had, when I was in journaling process, I was like, I'm tired, and like, I have two babies in cribs. And I was saying a lot of things that could be very stressful and were on the surface true. And as I got, and I was in terrible back pain, I literally could barely use the bathroom by myself. Like, this was very, very dire. And I'm journaling and I'm crying and I'm like, what is it? And I said, something happened. It was a spiritual awakening. It was a moment that I know we both believe in, because I've read your book. And it was a voice that came into my head that said, you're lying. And I talked back to the voice and I said, no, I'm not. I do have these situations. It said, no, these are not the repressed emotions that are making you so ill that you can't function in the world. What's going on? And I literally wrote the first line of journal speak I ever penned, which is, I hate being a mother. I hate it. I'm not doing it anymore. I've ruined my life. I've had these children and now I can't breathe and I can't function and I'm fucking it up all the time. And I just let it go. And what's amazing about journal speak is it doesn't stay true. So it transformed into, I hate my parents and F those guys. And they screwed it up and they made this decision and that. And they caused in me a child that required that I did it perfectly all the time, or I felt like I wouldn't be loved. And I went on and on. And then it turned on myself and I loathed myself. And I just blasted myself for my weakness. It was fantastic. Because I opened up the permission, the line I love that you say in the book, and I only listened mm-hmm. to the audible. Mm-hmm. Lisa was reading along, listening. I was on the beach with the audible, but you said, and I think it's in the envy chapter, you said something like, she needed permission to tell the truth about her resentment of her own daughter, her mm-hmm. envy and resentment mm-hmm. of her own daughter. That is journal speak. That is journal yeah. speak. And then like it's times a million. It's all, but here's the reason that is so amazing that I am excited to share with you because of what all the things you bring up in your book is that I've been working, this podcast that you're on right now, it goes out around the world. Millions of people listen to it. People go from being on disability to being back at work full-time, having babies, just doing this work. Paired with meditation and patience and kindness for yourself, because there's three facets of the work. Believe, which is you need to understand there is a connection between your stress and your illness in order for you to be well, or else the nervous system just keeps sending up barriers. So it's believe, do the work, which is the journal speak, and patience and kindness for yourself. Because if you're continuing to shit on yourself as you're doing it, it's like the law of diminishing returns. You're not going to get where you want to go. But people who practice these three facets and marinate in the belief and do the work, they get remarkably better.
I can imagine.
It's amazing. So we work together with people.
It's actually stunning. I might never have believed it if I were just basing it on, because I'm such a skeptic. If I were just basing it on the thousands of speak pipes that we get from our community saying, Nicole, you saved my life, you know, and other stories, I would, you know, it would move me. But I really had to experience it myself. And I was someone who had 8 to 9 migraines a month. And was on finally after every single medication, I was taking a preventative shot and I no longer take anything, nothing.
Wow. So I have a migraine disorder too. Yeah. No, but just even listening to you talk about the journaling and just the amount, I'm conscious of this in myself. I'm sure everyone is, like the amount of self-editing that I do and the way that I judge myself for thoughts that I think are bad. Mean, judgmental. I mean, it's actually wild once you become conscious of how intensely I attack myself. I'm like, I didn't even say that out loud, but yet the very idea that it exists in my consciousness is enough for me to condemn myself. But I'm sure what you find, I mean, it's all about goodness and badness, right? It's all about policing everything, even though it's like, we live in this culture that's so consumed with like I'm in the light and I'm a and it's like,
bypassing.
No, all the spiritual bypassing. It's like, yes, sure. Certainly. And you are full of shadow. Yes. That is what it is to be alive. It is our job to mix the two, to have a full experience. I am good. I am bad. I can be a real shit and I can be.
Yes. I was just, Lisa reads my mind. We've gotten to the point. That's why there are two things I forgot to say. One is you don't keep it. So you do the journal speak practice and you destroy it immediately. So if you're typing it into a document, you just press delete and you never save it.
In the same way that if you blew your nose into a tissue, you would not hold on to that.
Yeah. That's right. What one of my former clients said. It's like blowing your nose into the tissue. Like you're going to look at it again, throw it away. So that's what's very important. And the other thing is, it's totally a private experience. It is such a dance and it becomes a love story between you and you, because and this is why, once again, we were loving your book and your content, because in the end, what all of these things are inviting us to do is say, you're okay. Like you were never not okay. You were never not okay because you felt angry or sexual or hungry or envious. Like actually, you're built for this. You know, one of the things I say to my people whenever I'm lecturing or wherever I'm going is like, you are literally made for this, to have big feelings. Why are we here? Why are we here? When we get to take human form, it's because we get to feel things deeply and thoroughly, and we get to interact with other people. This doesn't happen in the in-between. Like we get to do this here, and the privilege is so great, but because we monitor it, as you say, police it so much and decide what's good and what's bad, All the bad needs to be repressed. This sweet human system, this body we have, it doesn't know any better. It seeks to protect. It's the same as if you're going to pull your hand off a hot stove. The migraine gets you where? Safe, in bed, away from the predators of your children, your life, your success, your self-criticism. It's literally perfection when you realize that it's happening.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Makes so much sense.
Yes.
I love also when you talk about Byron Katie saying we're disturbed not by what happens to us, but by our thoughts about what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk a little bit about how our stories, you know, both personal and cultural, shape the way we feel about what happens to us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the mind, as you guys know, it's so powerful, and we're meaning making machines. We tell stories about our experiences. It's how we come to understand the world and this like collective sort of myth making. And it's so easy to be self-defining. I'm sure you guys know Ellen Langer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. She has a new book coming out, I think in September, called, you would love it. It's called like The Mindful Body, I think. And it's an exposition of a lot of the studies that we love her for, you know, the chambermaid study, the way that our body, our mindfulness can completely impact our health. And she just gives, you know, several examples from her own life. And I was thinking about how true this is of her for me, but she was saying how, as like a young PhD student, someone just made an aside, oh, that's very creative. You know, and she was like, I'd never thought of myself like as a creative person. It just stuck in my mind. Oh, I'm creative. And she's done incredibly creative work really ever since. And you can talk about whether that's like an innate characteristic of Ellen Langer or whether we're just, I think, and her point is we are so persuadable. We are canvases for ourselves and for each other. And the way that we talk about our lives and our experiences very much shapes our experience. Like, you can see something bad can happen, and you, let's say you lose your job, and either that's the worst thing that could ever happen to you, it's a threat to your livelihood, you're a victim, they're bad, let's sue them. Or you can say, well, that was a gift. Yes, I'm having a stress response. Yes, I'm scared about my mortgage, but I am resilient. I always figure things out. I kind of hated that job. And clearly some sort of divine intervention setting me on a different path. And that's the same experience. It's just, I mean, it goes back to what we were talking about. You either see yourself, you see the world as happening to you, or you see yourself as someone who is co-creating your own experience.
Yeah. And that has a lot to do with our perception of safety, because your perception is your reality. And one thing that's fascinating about the human body is it responds exactly the same if you're unsafe or if you perceive yourself to be unsafe. If you hear a noise in your house and you know it's your teenager getting home and you're like, oh, phew, thank God she's home, that noise is the same noise that if you hear it and you think there's a prowler in your house. Your body is going to respond in completely different ways just based on your perception. So, you know, as you're saying, if you can have your mindset to perceive yourself as being someone who has agency and part of your own success, it's really, really contagious, you know, for all of your experiences. And the flip side of that, which I see a lot in walking through these years of working with people, is that illness and fear is also contagious. And that's, in my opinion, why there is such an epidemic right now of long COVID. You know, and I've worked with people, there are at least 5 or 6 people interviewed on this podcast who were completely disabled with long COVID. When I say disabled, meaning have left work, were having trouble with word retrieval, could not breathe well enough to walk from the kitchen to the bathroom, were being cared for by other people who have done this mind-body work, who are completely free of symptoms. One of the guys recently, Gary, yeah, in Long, he hikes mountains in New Zealand now after being down and out for months. But the thing is, when we're all collectively fearful of the same thing, the brain is so suggestible that it starts to buy into this, and the fear begets the meaning, begets the illness. So
yeah,
couldn't help but jump on that one, because I'm really adamant with by
we want to confirm our stories in the world. It makes complete sense. Everything we do makes so much sense. It's just start a different story.
Yes.
If you don't like it, tell another one.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say a couple of things that I love that you said that would be little thought starters. But in the same way that you said, I let my anger rise to show me where I betrayed myself. I think that is, you know, so much about when you write, it tells you what you think. And how journal speak can be this incredible journey inward. And certainly one of our favorite lines in your book, and this will transition us into sadness and then out to some of the conclusions, but one of the favorite lines was the cure for sadness is grief. You can't heal what you can't feel. And this act of expressing versus repressing feelings of loss, despair, fear, covert depression is so, you know, critical to what you suggest.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk some more about that? Or
yeah, and sadness, like for people who, someone who has really informed my thinking about that and is such an amazing resource is this therapist named Terry Real, who built his career primarily working with men, and then he started working with couples because that became the way to access men, and he's really good. He's sort of one of the greats in that space. And he's known for actually taking on men, confronting men, taking sides in therapy rather than just sort of watching people talk about their stories, talk about their content, which is really interesting. I feel like all the great couples therapists are very good at being like, the content's kind of boring. These stories are kind of boring. Like, what's the underlying dynamic that's happening here? But Terry talks a lot about men and depression, which I think is probably highly correlated with your book. And I write about his work a fair amount, which is that when you, he was like, this doesn't make sense to me, this prominent idea that sort of women are depressed. Because if you look at the rates of depression, it would appear that women are more depressed than men. And he was like, clearly there's so much stigma associated with this. Women probably feel more comfortable reporting it, certainly. But his model suggests that for men, it's actually trauma wrapped in an addictive defense, and that the depression is therefore covert. And that in order to make the depression overt, you have to access the trauma, pull the pin, and then let the covert depression morph into sadness and grief. And that the men have to sort of be willing to walk this wasteland of all this, again, this reservoir of unfelt feeling in a world that's very hard on men. I know that that doesn't sound accurate, but it's true. I think men are cut off from their feelings. It's devastating. I think the patriarchy is worse for men, even though what we prioritize or prize in our culture suggests like, no, they have all the power, therefore they're great. It's like, well, that's because we live in a culture that only prioritizes power, but they're not doing well. But this idea that, and so his point too was like, and reason for his model is like, when you look at the rates of depression, yes, women over-index in overt depression or clinical depression, but when you add up addiction, personality disorders, et cetera, you get an equivalence and far more culture harming. You know, you look at deaths of despair, you look at suicidality, you look at chaos in our culture. This is wounding boys that become wounding men. Sometimes it's wounded boys, but just shooting children. You know, this isn't women.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's true. Actually, I was thinking of this way earlier in the conversation when we were talking about men and women, that sadness is just so completely unacceptable for men, as unacceptable as anger is for women. And, you know, I do believe, and I see it in your book, that even though it speaks a lot of women, this book is also equally for men, because we all want to feel the freedom to feel our full spectrum of emotions. And when, like Lisa and I, we just were at Omega, I teach at the Omega Institute every year, and we taught together this year. And the men that come, they are so shut down. They are so needing, and it's so lovely that they come, because throughout the week you see what happens to them. I mean, they break down, they cry, and they leave like free. Like, you've never seen somebody transform like you see a man at a retreat like that. So, I mean, I really do very much hope to continue this work, you know, in that population. Yeah.
Yes, it's so needed. I'm gonna send my husband to you.
Yes, send him right on over.
Absolutely. And then I just, on a personal note, I want to say that the sadness chapter resonated so deeply for me. I feel like that you kind of more clearly articulated than anything that I've ever read the description of what I was going through in what I call divorce COVID, the private and the public pandemic going on at once.
Yes.
And I'm going to paraphrase what you said, but with a bit of quoting, but you said, sadness is a disorienting abyss without clear boundaries for when it will end. It also comes with it a cattle prod from society that just wants you to get over it already. But that's not how it works. It yields to no commands. It has its way with you, and it forces you to your knees in submission, which you describe as an essential prerequisite for resurrection. And I could not agree more. I mean, I would be, running in my neighborhood, anything to kind of get out of the house. And I began to sort of become addicted to this act of running. And a tsunami of despair, grief would just overcome me out of nowhere. And I would have to hold on to a tree, literally, to steady myself. And what you said about how it just doesn't respect linear time. Like, you intellectually know that you will be okay, and you know that you are going to get through this, and you understand that these cycles are the human condition, but your heart can't catch up.
Yeah.
And it just really, really stayed with me. Someone at Omega, because Nicole just brought this up, said that they were healing through this practice and through these tools that we give them, but that they were reluctant to let go of the last 10% of their suffering because they just wanted to know that it had mattered.
Yeah, that was like so powerful when she
said. Wow.
Yeah, it's like, and this is why, you know, my whole thing, I tend to be very passionate, and I'm like, I want you to heal, and I'm a huge cheerleader. But in the end, it becomes very gentle, because in order to really set ourselves free, we have to understand that we honor ourselves by living free. We honor ourselves by walking away from what is toxic, by inviting in what feels warm and good, by drawing boundaries where we might have felt that we don't have the right, but actually it keeps not only us safe, but it teaches other people to be safe too, and to draw their own boundaries and all the things we do for our children. And that's how we make it matter. You know, that tends to be the primary message, the final message, which is your life of freedom, your life of fulfillment and of wellness is enough of a tribute to that little girl or boy who was hurt and abused and mistreated and ignored and, you know, and silenced. Like, that's the way we honor ourselves.
Yes. And so powerful.
And I know Lisa wants to talk about the inevitability, because another thing that we found very healing, I'm wondering what you think about it as a mom and as a woman in society. Lisa called me, it was a few weeks ago, and she had a headache, not a migraine, but she was just like, okay, what's going on? Because that's what we do now. You know, we're like, okay,
now it's the alarm.
Yeah, the alarm bell's going off. Pay attention, you know, whether it's the hyperventilation or the jaw. We didn't even talk about the jaw. The jaw, that was great too. And so she said, you know, I've got the headache. And so we started talking, and she said, you know what? Here's the thing. Here's what's bothering me. Here's where the hose needs to be aimed. It never ends. It never ends. I finish one thing and there's another. I deal with one kid and there's another. I deal with one thing at work and there's another, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, yeah. I said, guess what? She said, what? I said, it never ends. Full stop. It never ends. Let's stop expecting it to. Let's stop expecting there to be relief. And that's something you said so much throughout your book, which is there was some like unconscious expectation that if I do enough, that if I achieve enough, I'll arrive at this place where I can get relaxed, where it's done, where I can just, oh, I see. And like, it is an incredible.
Elisa actually says denial will ruin you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Deny. Yes, exactly. Because it is with the understanding that it never ends that we find peace. That's where real equanimity lies, in not feeling like we can't have our experience, but rather just to come into full alignment with it. Because that's the truth.
Yes. No, there's no finish line. There's no sort of like, good job, you've done enough, you're good now. I mean, I think maybe people find that in retirement, who knows, but I know retirement is very disorienting for most people. And a different part of the process that, again, we're not good at collectively because we are so afraid of death. But yeah, there's no relief. It's always, and I think there's a difference. There is finding peace. There's no finish line, but there's also like, I'm trying to be really mindful of myself around the arrival fallacy. Like if I get this, then that, which is essentially the same thing. It's a different form of a finish line to just like, today is another day. Yes. Today is another day.
It's kind of the difference between what we provide people, which is the answer, this idea of staying. Do you want to describe the answer?
Yeah.
We know that it never ends. We know that that there will always be the cycle, but how we choose to greet that and the faith that we have that we will get through it is what changes it. So why don't you talk about the answer?
Yeah. So essentially one of the ways we communicate this work is that there's an acronym that we've created called the answer: allow, name, stay, and release. And it really kind of encompasses the whole process. We allow for our realities, our stories, our hurts, the places we haven't had our voice. We allow it. Instead of continually denying it and shoving it away, we just allow it. Just means we open the door and say, you may come in and sit. I don't know what I'm going to do with you, but you may be here. Naming is the journal speak process, which is doing this practice on a daily basis at the beginning and allowing that yourself to be with that which has happened. Name it, put it out in front of you so you are really seeing it, slowing down your thoughts in order to put them down on some sort of, you know, paper or keyboard, and then stay. So, I mean, that's what we're all really talking about, which is, as human beings, we are so programmed to run. We are programmed to run to addiction, to food, to anything that brings us out of our experience. And that is where Lisa and I both think this because we talk about it constantly, where the real healing resides, in understanding that it doesn't have to feel good, but that uncomfortable does not equal unsafe. Mm-hmm. And that is something that is so profound, because when we realize that uncomfortable doesn't equal unsafe, we can stay. And the natural consequence of allowing, naming, and staying is release. That's when we feel the freedom, and those are the moments, you know.
And if you don't make time for that, and if you don't really become mindful enough, and there's so much, you know, so much meditation and so many different mindfulness practices to help lead you to this place, not just the answer and what we teach, but if you never get there, then you experience what Nicole talks about, which is the struggle imperative, in the same way that a symptom will move around your body, a physical symptom, and you'll be chasing it. You'll have a migraine one day, and then it'll be your back hurts, and then your hip hurts. There's something called the struggle imperative,
right?
As well, and that is,
well, yeah. I mean, it's kind of what we're all talking about as women, as people, as human beings, which is you deal with one thing, okay, and you think it's the worst thing in the world. You know, I have to get my taxes done, or I have to get my child evaluated for their learning disability, or whatever it is that can be like very big. You get it done and it's almost immediate. The moment you get it done, it's the whack-a-mole. Something else arises that can be the just as big of a problem. And if you're not aware of
or
it,
not, but
it can
just
be forever.
You're gonna give it equal energy.
Yeah.
All things are equal. Everything. Because we are trained to put out, you know, these fake fires.
Oh, and here's the best. All of the fake fires get put out, and then I have like a moment of relaxing. You know what happens? I'm fat. It's like immediately, just like, I'm fat. No, I think I'm fat. And I literally laugh out loud sometimes at myself, because the thought, you don't have a control over the thought that arises. And I'm like, I cannot believe that's what we're doing right now. Really? Right. We have one moment where everybody seems fine and I'm fat now, you know?
Yeah.
So that's
where this stillness practice, this faith comes in. And I love how you reference Carissa Schumacher talking about how if you don't make space, we will make it for you.
Yes. And that being the divine. And that has been my experience. It's like, you have to learn, I can't remember the four, it's space, stillness. There are four, but space and stillness are enough. They're all sort of qualities of the same energy, but it's coming for you. We will cancel things, essentially, is what she was saying. Like, we will make things disappear until you allow space. And it's true. It's like such, been such an enduring and important lesson for me, because I recognize that instinct that I have, which is when I feel uncomfortable slash unsafe, as you said, even though the two are not, I tend to equate them in my mind. I immediately go into busyness mode. And for me, that will be like, I need another job. I need another like consultant. You know, I just go into this like false, it's in some ways real, but not really, sort of false sense of insecurity, where like, I better make it rain. And then of course, and a week later, when that feeling of uncomfortableness has passed and I have a new project that I don't really want to do, it's like, what are you doing? You know? But I'm much more conscious of that instinct and that things will be canceled if I don't make space and keep it.
And that's exactly the same with TMS theory. If you don't feel your feelings, your body will make space for your safety. If you don't understand how you really feel about going into work, your body will give you a migraine or a backache or, you know, a stomach thing. So you don't have to go there. And we just loved how it tracked. Yeah. It just was beautiful. Yeah. It's all the same.
But using the tools and becoming, you know, more aware of these things, you've certainly surfaced this now for a whole audience of people who have read this. And, you know, Nicole, you do the same. I think that there is a way to kind of, as things come up, make sure that you deal with them differently, make sure that you take it to the page, make sure that you provide time for the pause, for the stillness, and then really recognize how you change over time. We talk about ascension. You talk about ascension. I love that. Like when I saw ascension, I was like, my head almost,
we did a whole podcast on ascension last summer,
but yeah. I think that we both use the term similarly. You explained it that, you know, it was never meant to describe a journey up to heaven out there, yeah, but rather a journey back to our true selves, which is so beautiful. Yes. And, you know, you can describe the way we see it as concentric circles.
Yeah, it's ascension. Yeah. It's
a very ascension and ascension. Yeah.
Yes. Like, so you were saying it's not about getting to heaven. And what we say about ascension is it is a journey. Let's just say metaphorically up the mountain, but it's not from the base to the pinnacle of the mountain. It's concentric circles up the mountain. And so that's why on the healing journey, when we hear from people and they say, I recovered from my back pain. I never felt it, but now it's back and I'm right back where I started. We say, no. You're never right back where you started. You're in a rung, three or four rungs up the mountain. So look up, wake up, become aware, and look down and say, am I really the same person? Right. And every time, you know, undeniably,
how could you possibly be knowing what you know?
I've come so far. You know, it's just so important to help people understand that, because then they know that, and that also calms down the panic and the meaning making, and allows people to be present in their experience.
So Elise, I want you to talk about this enslavement to ideas of how we should be, pulling us away from who we really are and our attempt to be good, severing us from the good.
Yeah. I mean, that's the good. I mentioned Mary Magdalene briefly, and I love Mary Magdalene. And in her gospel, which was deemed heretical and cast out, and that's like a whole fascinating history for people who are interested, but she talks about, and she's the one, you know, in the New Testament, she's the one described as the one from whom Jesus cast seven demons. It's never clear what those are. Theologians have asserted that he was balancing her chakras. She's then therefore the most sanctified person in the Bible, et cetera. And then when Christ resurrects, regardless of your belief, this is sort of the story. So I'm giving you the story. He resurrects to her. She's the one who is there. She mistakes him for a gardener. Then he gives her this big teaching, which becomes the Gospel of Mary, which is cast out, destroyed, discovered only in recent times in the desert. And it's a very beautiful gospel. There are pages that are missing, but in it, he describes encountering these seven powers. And his descension on his ascent back to God, source, more, whatever you want to call it. And, but he tells her essentially, God, just to summarize in plain English, essentially like the goodness is in you. It's part of who you are. It's baked into all of you. And when you sort of do things that are adulterous to your nature, you go farther and farther from the root. Yeah. And essentially what I believe his saying is like, this is, you're half human, half divine, however you want to imagine yourself, but you are you, you're good. You're good. This is not a quality that can be adjudicated by any exterior authority. It's not up for debate. And yes, we all have, some of us have more shadow than others, some more distortions, some more stuff to work through, perhaps carry a heavier load, but this is it. This is life. You're just, this is who you are. And part of, you know, I talk about these sins. The book is not, you know, I could have written sort of a like stunty book about let's go be really lustful and gluttonous. It's not that. It's about reconciliation and balance. And it's about owning all of these parts of ourselves and using these sins as GPS points on our journey back to ourselves, sort of following that same journey that he describes to Mary Magdalene of like encountering these powers. And he gives them a slightly different spin, but like using them, this is yourself. Yeah. This is, you're talking to yourself. So listen.
I know. I wish those were the ones that people were familiar with, because when I read them, as you described it,
and a lot of that is Carissa Schumacher again, but helping me sort of understand that explication. But yeah, this idea, it's like, wrathful, there's two types of justice. One is sort of this like, I know better for you. Instead of working on myself, I'm going to save you. I know what's best. That instinct, that energy versus like
wisdom of the flesh, the condescension and certain
things. Yes.
That can help people, right?
Oh yeah, totally. All of them. I can find myself in all of them, but they're so subtle and nuanced and absolutely where you sort of like tip over into worrying about other, refusing to own what's in your yard and sort of like pushing it onto your neighbors.
Yeah. And I love how you say that the person that you need to speak to is yourself.
Yes.
You know, you are good. I mean, essentially, like I said, our messages are exactly the same, which is so lovely. You know, I like to say that everything true is the same. And the most hilarious experience I have, and I have it often, is I'll be just, you know, sitting in meditation or sitting in my bedroom and I'll come up with something and I'll be like, I just thought of something so profound, truly believing that I thought of it. And a couple of days later, I'll be reading, you know, Rumi or like Hafiz, yes. And I'll be like, oh shit, someone thought of it in like the 12th century, you know? And so it's really just about knowing that like when we are connected to source, when we're connected to our inner goodness, yes. To our highest good, to our essential truth,
yeah.
And our nature, this, the ideas that come forth are generally the same. Which is about going inside. It's an inside job, and there are tools with which to live in the solution. Right. And
by accepting all of the parts.
Yes.
We talked about that too. All of our parts. There are no bad parts. When we accept all of our parts, we achieve wholeness and freedom.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I guess lastly, right?
Yes.
Can we wrap? So
I
know we're taking so much of your time, but I could talk about this book for a week and we wouldn't get through it. But I did find it really interesting and parallel again, your discussion of how the body naturally heals and restores equilibrium. And after a bender, you're going to get a hangover, and our pain is often sent as protection, we talk about in the chronic pain world. Can you just describe that a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, obviously our bodies, as much as attuned as we are to sort of these signs or what's going wrong or these symptoms, for the most part, our bodies are incredible at homeostasis and keeping us balanced and hydrated and upright. It's quite incredible, right? The dance that they do. And it's interesting, like, yes, we're very powerful, but I think sometimes we forget about, and I do believe we can affect our autonomous nervous system, et cetera. But for the most part, like our bodies are masterful at keeping us in restoration. And then of course we like do lots of things to ourselves to throw ourselves out of balance. And so I wrote a bit about Anna Lemke's work, and she wrote Dopamine Nation, and she's an addiction medicine specialist. And she just talks about like how the brain and the body both have this inclination towards balance. And so when we live in this culture of addiction, of more, 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 of denial, but ascension and sort of restricting and permitting, right? Like we all recognize the way that we're sort of on a little bit of a what's that playground thing?
Oh, the seesaw.
The seesaw. And that the brain, though, will, like, when we overindulge, it compensates with pain.
Yes.
Too much pleasure, you're going to have pain in order to restore balance. And this isn't to say, like, in the context of this conversation about chronic pain, that, like, you have painful back because you're just having way too much fun, you know, in your daily life.
You might be having shame over having way too much fun. You know, to me, it's not about the fun you're having. It's about the way you're perceiving yourself to be. And if you feel undeserving, or if you feel that it's gluttonous to have that kind of experience, it can go that direction. Cause it's all about what is deemed safe by your nervous system.
Yeah. No. So I think that's thinking about sort of medicine, understanding that, or just, like, looking at pain in that context too, I think is a much more wholesome, is such a weird word, but, like,
a whole way.
It's really probably makes so much sense, but I don't think that we've heard sort of the typical medical model talking about it as like a completely normal rebalancing effort on the part of the body to sort of maintain homeostasis.
Well, I mean, I don't know if anyone could describe it better than what you said. The pleasure of the exhale is the antidote to the clutch of the inhale.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's all so aligned. Elise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming and talking to us today. It was really, really excellent. For everyone out there, go wherever you get books and check out On Our Best Behavior, The 7 Deadly Sins and The Price Women Pay to Be Good by Elise Lunin. It was a pleasure talking with you today.
Thanks, guys. It was so fun.
So fun. Thank you so much.
And let's do it again. I can't wait for your book.
Yes. Well, we're all going to be waiting. We're all going to be waiting a minute, while, but we will.
Not really. That's fast.
Time flies. Well, for everyone out there, as you know, this has been the Cure for Chronic Pain podcast with me, Nicole Sachs, and we will see you next week. Bye-bye.